content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the March 24th, 2017 issue of The Week magazine. As I did last week, I'm going to try to describe the artwork on the cover for you. This week, it's a picture of Paul Ryan. He's dressed in a doctor's lab coat and stethoscope. In one hand, he's got a bottle of castor oil, and in the other hand, coming out into the foreground, is a big heaping spoonful of it. The title says, Bitter Medicine, Why Ryan Care Would Leave 24 Million More Americans Without Health Care Coverage. And with that picture in mind, we'll go right into the main stories. CBO report roils Ryan Care debate. What happened? House Republicans were struggling to rally congressional support for their proposal to replace the Affordable Care Act this week after a highly anticipated report by the Congressional Budget Office, CBO, predicted that the bill would cause the number of Americans without health insurance to grow by 24 million by 2026. The proposed legislation, the American Health Care Act, would scrap the individual mandate, which imposes tax penalties on those who don't have insurance, replace income-based premium subsidies with smaller tax credits linked to age, and reverse Obamacare's Medicaid expansion. The CBO, a nonpartisan group currently led by a Republican-picked appointee, estimated that this plan would lead to 14 million more uninsured Americans after the first year and another 10 million after caps on Medicaid funding go into effect in 2020. The bill would reduce the deficit by $337 billion over the next decade, the CBO projected, and premiums would shrink to 10% below what they would be under Obamacare by 2026, but only after jumping 15% to 20% over the next 2 years. The analysis concluded that older, low-income Americans buying insurance on the individual market would pay substantially more for health care than they do now. The CBO report created turmoil among Republicans, with Senator Tom Cotton, Republican from Arkansas, saying that if Republicans vote for this bill, they're going to put the House majority at risk next year. House Speaker Paul Ryan, the primary author of the health care plan, insisted that a reduction in the number of insured would be mostly voluntary. Our plan is not about forcing people to buy expensive one-size-fits-all coverage, Ryan said. But at least a dozen GOP senators raised concerns over Ryan Care's impact on seniors and Medicaid recipients in their states and said the bill would need to be altered. More conservative lawmakers said the bill didn't go far enough in reducing government subsidies for health care coverage. There's not really any kind of coalition that's going to get the Ryan bill to pass, said Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky. President Trump continued to express support for the bill, but talked this week with GOP leaders about potential revisions. Ryan was counting on the president to pressure House members to fall in behind the proposal, which Trump has yet to decide to do. What the editorial said. So much for Trump's pledge of insurance for everybody, said the New York Times. Ryan Care would produce an enormous amount of human misery by throwing millions of Americans off their health coverage, raising deductibles for everyone, and shifting costs from younger, healthier people who would no longer have to buy insurance to seniors. Why are Republicans pushing it. Simple. The law would scrap $600 billion in taxes that pay for Obamacare subsidies, giving a gigantic tax cut to wealthy Americans. There's good news in the CBO report, particularly the deficit reduction of $337 billion, said the Wall Street Journal. The report suggests most of the initial coverage plunge of $14 million would be the result of freeing Americans from the individual mandate so they could choose not to buy insurance. Besides, CBO models are not a writ carved in stone by a finger of light. They wildly overestimated the number of original Obamacare enrollees and often discount the effect of market forces. The GOP should have confidence that their ideas will work and march ahead. What the columnist said, Ryan is stuck between two diametrically opposed GOP factions, said Andrew Prokop in Vox.com. On one side is the hardline conservative House Freedom Caucus, which thinks the bill fails to roll back enough of Obamacare. On the other side is a disparate group of lawmakers who fear the reforms will cause too many people to lose coverage. The Coverage Caucus is just as capable of scuttling the bill as the Freedom Caucus, and Ryan can't please one without infuriating the other. To make this bill less politically poisonous, Republicans simply have to get the coverage numbers up, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. They could easily allocate more money to make the tax credit more generous further down the income scale. Arguing that people don't need health insurance sounds like stereotypical Republican heartlessness and will backfire badly. Republicans might be better off passing nothing, said Megan McArdle in BloombergView.com. If they force the Ryan bill through without any Democratic votes, they'll end up with 100% of the blame for everything people dislike about the health care system. Far better to wait for Obamacare's exchanges to fully collapse, enact a comprehensive conservative overhaul. Why is President Trump backing this bill, asked Byron York in WashingtonExaminer.com. He was elected to bring back and create jobs, cut taxes and regulations, and put a jolt into the economy. But he's allowing House Republicans to drag him into a complex, time-consuming, and unpopular fight over an issue that isn't a priority for most voters. Republicans are working on the wrong things, and if Trump lets them set his agenda, he may end up burning through much of his political capital with little reward. Our controversy of the week, Pruitt, the EPA chief who's a climate change skeptic. In his confirmation hearing, Scott Pruitt was careful to walk a fine line between accepting and denying climate science, said Emily Atkin in NewRepublic.com. Now he's settled in as head of the Environmental Protection Agency, however. Oklahoma's former attorney general has come out of the closet as a full-blown climate change denier. In a TV interview last week, Pruitt expressly denied that human-produced carbon dioxide is changing the climate. No, I would not agree that it's a primary contributor to the global warming that we see, Pruitt said. He obviously does not understand science or reason, said Ryan Cooper in TheWeek.com. Experiments show that carbon dioxide absorbs infrared heat and keeps it from radiating out into space. A greenhouse with a lot of carbon dioxide gets hotter than one with low levels. Carbon dioxide levels in our atmosphere have soared as civilization burns fossil fuels, and the world is undeniably heating up. Nearly all climate scientists agree the resulting droughts and heat waves, rising sea levels, and other changes pose a grave danger to humanity. Yet the man President Trump tapped to run the agency charged with defending this nation against its most serious threat doesn't even believe the threat is real. That makes Pruitt a clear and present danger to American national security and to humanity. Pruitt is absolutely right, said Robert Trusinski in TheFederalist.com. While the data show a rise in both global temperature and CO2 levels in recent decades, Association does not prove causation. The computer models predicting catastrophic warming presume the existence of a feedback loop in which a relatively small injection of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere triggers a large warming effect. But how would this mechanism work in the real world, and how sensitive is the climate to CO2? Nobody really knows. These are vital questions, said Julie Kelly in NationalReview.com. By challenging climate change orthodoxy, Pruitt is setting the stage for a long overdue and critical debate about how much of an impact CO2 has on global warming, one that we need to have before regulations cost our economy trillions. Nice try, said Robinson Meyer in TheAtlantic.com. The right is now embracing the concept of study and debate as a stall, refusing to cede what actual study and debate have found. The Trump administration will give us more of the same dissembling this week when the president issues an executive order repealing the Clean Power Plan, which restricted emissions from power plants. After that, Trump and Pruitt plan to gut the federal fuel economy standards that regulate consumer vehicles' tailpipe emissions. Meanwhile, Trump will reportedly cut the EPA's budget by at least 25% and lay off 3,000 workers. Trump has declared a war on the climate, and Pruitt is his loyal general. This is about something deeper and more corrosive than deregulation, said David Roberts in Vox.com. Trump is on a mission to undermine the credibility of every knowledge-producing institution in our democracy and to establish himself as the ultimate source of truth, at least in the eyes of his supporters. Part of Scott Pruitt's job at the EPA is to do to science, what Trump himself is already doing to the press, the courts, and the intelligence community. Smearing it as just another biased purveyor of politicized fake news. Trump can delegitimize science all he wants, said Bill McKibben in the New York Daily News, but he can't repeal the laws of physics and chemistry. Sooner or later, the truth will out and humanity will pay the price. It was a good week for smiley faces after German researchers found that 97% of observers perceived the Mona Lisa's expression to be unequivocally happy, not ambiguous as art historians have long contended. It was a good week for sticking the landing after James Sunby of Minnesota somehow survived without serious injury when he accidentally drove his car off an embankment, soared 210 feet over Lake L'Homme Dieu, and landed on its partially frozen surface. The fact that guy is even alive is a miracle, a police spokesman said. And it was a good week for procreating, after researchers in France found that having children increases life expectancy by about 2 years, especially for widowed or divorced older men. The scientists speculate that elderly parents benefit from the social and financial support of their adult offspring can provide. But it was a bad week for the big hand and the little hand, after a new study found that only 20% of 6 to 12-year-olds in Oklahoma could read the time from an analog clock. It was a bad week for Washington, D.C.'s cherry blossoms, which were damaged by a snowstorm and sub-freezing weather just a few days before their peak bloom. You're going to experience a 90% loss of blossoms, said a spokesman for the National Park Service. And it was a bad week for intra-party unity, after a leaked audio tape recorded shortly before the November election revealed House Speaker Paul Ryan telling fellow Republicans, "I am not going to defend Donald Trump, not now or in the future." Ryan said this week that those comments are ancient history. We're on the briefing page now. Rescuing the Rust Belt. President Trump promised to reverse the decades-long decline of manufacturing jobs. Can it be done? Why is the Rust Belt hurting? Once the booming heart of America's manufacturing industry, the Rust Belt is now dotted with derelict factory buildings, empty warehouses, and struggling downtowns filled with pawn shops and boarded up stores. The region, which stretches from western New York State to Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, and Wisconsin, has been in serious decline since 1979, the year that U.S. manufacturing employment peaked. Over the past four decades, manufacturing jobs have plunged by 7 million as factories have downsized, closed, and outsourced work to low-wage countries such as Mexico and China. Young people have fled these blighted communities, and amid poverty and hopelessness, a growing number of those left behind have turned to opioids and other drugs to cope. In 2016, much of this once heavily unionized region flipped for Trump, who promised to remove the rust from the Rust Belt by renegotiating trade deals and slapping tariffs on imports. "We will stop these countries from taking our jobs," Trump said while campaigning in Erie, Pennsylvania. "I promise we can fix it so fast." What does Trump intend to do? Trump already claims credit for pressuring several companies, including Carrier, to keep or create jobs in the U.S. In November, the Indiana air conditioning manufacturer announced it would choose not to move 800 jobs to Mexico in exchange for various economic incentives. But even if Trump made similar deals every week for the next 4 years, he would bring back only 4% of the manufacturing jobs lost since 2000, according to a New York Times analysis. On a broader level, Trump has floated the possibility of tariffs and import taxes of 20 to 35% on products made in Mexico, China, and other countries. Calling trade deals the greatest jobs theft in history, the president also vowed to renegotiate NAFTA. Will these policies work? Few economists think so. The reality is that trade deals have played only a small part in the Rust Belt's decline. The U.S. lost half its manufacturing jobs before 1994, the year NAFTA took effect, and 7 years before China joined the World Trade Organization. The much bigger culprit in job loss was the one that has taken the man out of manufacturing, automation. About 85% of the 5 million factory jobs lost between 2000 and 2010 can be blamed on technology and robots, according to a Ball State University study. That's why virtually all economists agree that bringing back millions of lost jobs is unlikely. Trump deserves credit for taking seriously the anxieties and anger and frustration in these communities, said Mark Moreau, a specialist in economic development at the Brookings Institution. But Trump's promise to bring back millions of jobs is a pipe dream, he says, and could backfire. Who could be hurt? If Trump adopts a protectionist trade policy, it would likely result in retaliatory tariffs on U.S. exports to Canada, China, Mexico, and other countries. A trade war would badly hurt American farmers, who get 30% of their revenue from exporting produce and meat abroad. Major U.S. corporations derive 40% of their profits from foreign sales and would have to lay off workers if there were a trade war. So are Rust Belt workers doomed? Not necessarily, but economists agree they do need to be retrained for the new manufacturing age, which requires workers who can program and operate computers and robots. The U.S. will need to fill 3.5 million skilled jobs in specialized manufacturing over the next decade, according to a 2016 White House report. To help fill that demand, the Trump administration could create training programs that connected community colleges to local companies. Another job growth area is health and educational services, with positions for nurses, healthcare aides, and teachers. That sector grew 43% in several Rust Belt states between 1996 in 2016. But the potential for service jobs and manufacturing retraining is limited. Many blue-collar men in their 40s and 50s see service jobs as women's work and are intimidated by the idea of being retrained to operate computers. For that reason, some social scientists have offered a more drastic solution. What's that? Relocation. Henry Olson, a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, says lawmakers should pass a new Homestead Act that would subsidize people who want to leave the Rust Belt for booming urban areas like Houston and Los Angeles. In these areas, job growth is brisk. A Brookings study of a similar relocation experiment from the 1990s, known as Moving to Opportunity, found that poor families who relocated with help from the Department of Housing and Urban Development often ended up happier and healthier than families who stayed behind. Many of the Rust Belt's historic steel towns and manufacturing hubs simply cannot be saved, said Galen Newman, assistant professor of urban planning at Texas A&M. I think we're going to have to let some of them go, says Newman. Why robots replaced people. Contrary to rumor, U.S. manufacturing is not in decline. The value of goods manufactured in this country hit an all-time high last year. But because of automation, it takes far fewer employees to make those goods today than during the Rust Belt's golden era. Today, for example, a spot welding robot in the auto industry costs the employer $8 an hour, compared with $25 for a worker. And robots are getting more sophisticated every year. One such machine from the Universal Robots can solder, paint, screw, glue, and grasp items, and even repair itself when damaged. A steel mill like we have here 20 years ago, it would have to be run by 5,000 or 6,000 people, said Ohio State Senator Sean O'Brien. Now it's 800 people because of automation. As technology becomes ever more sophisticated, job losses will grow, not diminish. A 2013 study projected that as many as 47% of U.S. jobs could be lost to automation and robots over the next two decades. And we'll read a few columns now. The first two are from the U.S. For Democrats, a revival won't be easy. President Trump's chaotic beginning has many Democrats envisioning a big comeback, said Roger Altman. But their hope that Trump will self-destruct and take the Republican Party with him ignores the decrepit state of the Democratic Party at all levels of government. Republicans not only control Congress and the presidency, they are even more dominant on the state level, holding 33 governorships and more than two-thirds of state legislative chambers. Yet many Democrats think the party simply has a messaging problem and can return to power by moving left to a neo-socialist Bernie Sanders platform of higher taxes, lavish benefits, and more government control of everything. That's delusional. When Democrats move too far left, it results in Republican landslides. Remember Walter Mondale and Michael Dukakis? What the party actually needs is an overarching economic message that resonates beyond campuses and the coasts. As Bill Clinton and Barack Obama demonstrated, Democrats win when they focus on economic growth, middle-class tax relief, and affordable health care. Until Democrats reinvent their party to appeal to a broader swath of Americans, they'll continue to be on the outside of power, looking in. A technology temperance movement. Admit it, says Ross Douthat. You are enslaved to the internet. If you're like most Americans, your existence is increasingly dominated by a compulsion to check email, Twitter, Facebook, and/or Instagram with a frequency that bears no relationship to any communicative need. That's because our devices and the wondrous functions they can perform are built to addict us, to give us dopamine hits of outrage, ego reinforcement, arousal, and distraction. In return, we sacrifice our privacy, our attention span, our focus on our families, and our awareness of the natural world. The smartphone is in the saddle, and it rides mankind. To take back control, we need a digital temperance movement. As with other intoxicating substances, use of the internet should be restricted by both custom and law. Restaurants and museums should require people to check their phones. Corporations should prohibit employees from checking emails during meetings. Elementary schools shouldn't use computers at all. If this sounds extreme, please note that Silicon Valley's overlords send their kids to schools that ban all tech. Only a movement can save you from the tyrant in your pocket. And that's from South Korea. South Korea's disgraced ex-president, Park Geun-hye, is still causing mayhem, said the hankyore, as the nation's top court formally removed her from office last week, upholding parliament's impeachment of Park over a corruption scandal that saw companies pay some $70 million to her shadowy advisor, Choi Sun-sil. Her supporters rioted in the streets. Three protesters died in clashes with police. Park should now be begging the country's forgiveness for the chaos she has sown in recent months. But in her first statement since her ouster, Park expressed no contrition or remorse, made no call for national unity, and didn't apologize to the dead protesters' families. Instead, she attempted to undermine the impeachment decision, declaring that, in time, "I believe the truth will certainly come out." Evidently, she is still trying to muster her supporters with a message of defiance. Hasn't enough blood been shed? This is highly irresponsible and dangerous. Park's actions in the wake of her removal only show how right Parliament was to cut short her tenure. A true leader would see the country's need for confidence in the constitutional process and would urge citizens to participate vigorously in the campaign for her successor. Park's willingness to do anything for her own interest, regardless of what it means for the country, is shameless and despicable. And now the last word, how disasters happen. When things go terribly wrong, it's natural to look for outrageous incompetence, said journalist James B. Meigs. But as the Oscars debacle showed, banal mistakes, complacency, and denial can lead to monumental error. In every disaster, there's an instant when the awful truth first presents itself to the stunned participants. A lookout spots an iceberg, or methane gas starts jetting from the top of a drilling rig. At the 89th Academy Awards, this happened on live TV, so we all got to see the precise moment Warren Beatty realized something had gone terribly wrong. His eyebrows arched upward. He frowned, hesitated. The meltdown that followed was epic. Beatty peered into the envelope again as if to see whether the second slip of paper were lurking inside. Then he handed the befuddling card to his co-presenter, Faye Dunaway, who, unaware of the disaster still, immediately announced La La Land had won Best Picture. That film's producers were more than 2 minutes into their speeches before the truth came out. Beatty had been handed the wrong envelope before he took the stage. Moonlight was the real winner. This may have been an unprecedentedly public disaster, but on a historical scale, it was hardly a catastrophe. Yet the chain of events that led to the debacle and the way the participants reacted to it are familiar to anyone who has studied disasters like the sinking of the Titanic or the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. Life is full of unlikely outcomes. A long shot wins the presidency or a Super Bowl team overcomes a 25-point deficit. But when disasters occur, we assume such shocking events must have appropriately massive causes. What the Oscars debacle teaches us is that the mistakes that lead to chaos are often surprisingly minor and random. Or as Charles Perrow, author of a book on accidents, writes, accident reconstruction reveals the banality and triviality behind most catastrophes. Banality and triviality certainly abound in the case of the big Academy Awards envelope switcheroo, standing in the wings and handing envelopes to presenters as they take the stage doesn't sound like a complex job, but a number of factors converged in just the right way to enable the error. The first was a decision to allow PricewaterhouseCoopers, the accounting firm that has famously tallied Oscar voting for the past 83 years, to single-handedly manage the envelope process. The company takes great pride in its Academy Award role, so its partners, Martha Ruiz and Brian Cullinan, rather than, say, stagehands or administrative staffers, personally hand the envelopes to the presenters. But having senior executives taking such a frontline role can be a recipe for trouble. They're more likely to assume they're going to do it right. Many accidents have been triggered by the very experienced workers who grew overconfident and complacent. Wilderness fighters, for example, are most likely to be killed or injured in their 10th year on the job. That's just about the time they start to think they've seen it all, says Carl Week, a University of Michigan psychologist who studies disasters. Cullinan, the accountant who handed Beatty the wrong envelope, was in his fourth year of doing Oscars duty. Compared with grinding through the accounts of global corporations, shuffling awards envelopes probably seemed like a lark to him, a nice perk. Clearly, Cullinan felt relaxed in the role. He even found time to tweet a picture of Best Actress winner Emma Stone clutching her award backstage. Since the Best Actress award was the last one to be presented before Best Picture, that meant Cullinan was busy tweeting just seconds before handing out the final envelope. Staying focused while doing simple repetitive tasks is a challenge for most people, but there is evidence that less senior workers are sometimes more attentive. The anxiety that comes from being new to a job appears to help keep people alert. U.S. Navy aircraft carriers, for example, routinely include well-trained but surprisingly inexperienced sailors on the crews that perform the dicey work of launching and recovering aircraft. So Cullinan may have been at higher risk for making a mistake. Why was he there in the first place? The Academy maintains extraordinary secrecy in order to keep the results from leaking. There is no master list of winners in the broadcast booth, and even Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Science President Cheryl Boone Isaacs doesn't know who won. The only people who know the winners in advance are the two PwC partners carrying the black briefcases. That system dates back to the 1940 Academy Awards ceremony when the Los Angeles Times broke an embargo and published the winners hours before the event. Restricting knowledge of the winners to the two PwC representatives has kept Oscar's secrets from leaking ever since. But the practice also made it impossible for the show's director or anyone else to know immediately that a mistake had been made. Another safety procedure that went awry concerns how the envelopes are handed out. Ruiz and Cullinan each had a full set of envelopes in their respective briefcases. Ruiz stood in the wings at stage left, Cullinan at stage right. Each time a presenter took the stage, either Ruiz or Cullinan would hand him or her the proper envelope. That meant that when the presenter entered from, say, stage left, Cullinan at stage right would be left with an unneeded duplicate envelope. Why bother with all those duplicates? To be ready just in case a presenter unexpectedly entered from the wrong side. But it also creates more opportunities for confusion. When Leonardo DiCaprio took the appropriate envelope from Ruiz before presenting the Best Actress award, that left Cullinan with the unneeded Best Actress envelope. When Beatty swept by a few moments later, Cullinan somehow handed the actor the Best Actress envelope and not the one labeled Best Picture. A precaution intended to solve one problem ended up creating another. Much of the Oscars mishap's drama came from the fact that it occurred on the final award of the night. This isn't surprising. An outsized share of accidents happen near the end of projects or missions. The Deepwater Horizon explosion occurred after the drillers had completed the well and were preparing to remove their drilling equipment. In mountaineering, the majority of accidents happen on the descent. This is an understandable human tendency. It is only natural to relax a bit when you think you are over the hump. Even the design of the envelope that Beatty carried to the stage played a role in the fiasco. Until recently, the award envelopes were gold, with large white labels designating the category. This year, the design was changed to a red envelope with a more subtle gold lettering. The bright red might have looked stunning on television, but the tasteful gold letters on a dark background turned out to be much harder to read. Had the letters been more legible, Cullinan, Beatty, or even Dunaway might have caught the mistake in time. Overtrained individuals, needless safety precautions, and the understandable tendency to let up at the end helped create the disaster condition. Why couldn't one quick-thinking person stop it? When Beatty pulled the card from the envelope and saw the words, Emma Stone, La La Land, he knew he'd been holding the wrong envelope, but he didn't say so. In the aftermath of such events, we all like to assume we would have handled the situation correctly. But Beatty's reaction was in keeping with human nature. All of us have strong mental models of what to expect in given situations. Disaster expert Wyke calls this process sense-making. Processing information that doesn't fit our sense-making models is difficult, he says, even for experts. Beatty expected the card to include the name of a single movie, not the name of an actress and a movie. He knew there was a problem. On the other hand, he'd taken the envelope directly from the hand of a partner in PwC, a firm renowned for its bulletproof reliability. And the movie the card did mention was La La Land, the film everyone expected to win Best Picture. You can see the wheels turning in Warren's head, says Ann Thompson, editor-at-large for entertainment site IndieWire. Beatty stalled for time. Then he showed the card to Dunaway. He seemed to be looking for a second opinion, hoping she would confirm his sense that a mistake had been made. But Dunaway, already annoyed by what she perceived as his showboating, didn't hesitate. When she glanced at the card, her mind zeroed in on the words she expected to see, La La Land, and tuned out the words, Emma Stone. Such selective attention is common in high-stress situations. The pilots on the doomed Air France Flight 447, for example, tuned out the loud stall warning, which indicated that their plane's nose was too high for the wings to provide lift, and focused on keeping their wings level even as the craft was plunging toward the ocean. Why didn't the PwC accountants, the only two people who knew about the mistake, immediately rushed to the microphone and announced the correct winner? According to veteran Oscars stage manager Gary Natoli, the two partners simply froze. Again, this is not unusual. Many disasters, including the Three Mile Island nuclear accident and the Deepwater Horizon spill, could have been prevented if the operators on the scene had reacted immediately to signs of trouble. The PwC partners were supposed to have memorized all the winners, but neither one reacted. The La La Land producers began their thank you speeches. Meanwhile, backstage, it took more than a minute before Cullinan told a stage manager that he didn't think they'd named the right winner. More time passed before someone asked Ruiz to open her envelope. Such seemingly lackadaisical reactions are surprisingly common in the midst of disasters. It took the crew of Deepwater Horizon more than a minute to sound the alarm after explosive gas started enveloping the platform, and even longer to disconnect the rig from the well. after the Costa Concordia cruise ship struck a rock off the Italian coast. Crew members told passengers that the problem had been solved and to return to their cabins, even as the boat began to sink. Denial and disbelief are hardwired into human consciousness. When events deviate from our mental models, it can be almost impossible to comprehend what's going on, and our tendency to freeze up in stressful situations may reflect a primitive survival instinct. Animals that freeze rather than run might avoid being seen by predators. Finally, it was La La Land producer Jordan Horowitz, ironically, someone with the strongest interest in believing that the movie actually had won, who stepped up to the microphone. "I'm sorry, there's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture." As in the case of so many catastrophes before it, the causes of the great Oscars envelope flap were invisible to all the participants beforehand, but quite easy to see in retrospect. No doubt the Academy will reassess many of its procedures, the extreme secrecy, relying on accounting executives to manage backstage functions, those duplicate envelopes. The Academy has already announced that Ruiz and Cullinan will not be welcome at any future ceremony, but no matter how many changes are instituted, the potential for future mistakes will remain. Disasters teach a humbling lesson. No matter how careful we think we are, and often in spite of the care we take, there's always another string of unseen dominoes waiting to topple. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Slate.com. We'll read one of the obituaries today. The author who made Madison County famous, Robert James Waller, 1939-2017. Robert James Waller lived out every aspiring author's dream. In the early 1990s, the then 52-year-old University of Northern Iowa business professor came up with a plot for a novel. It concerned a photographer, Robert Kincaid, also 52, who visits Iowa's Madison County in 1965 to photograph its covered bridges for National Geographic. Kincaid has a chance encounter with a 45-year-old Italian-born farm wife, Francesca Johnson, and the pair embark on a passionate four-day affair while her family is away. Waller wrote the first draft of The Bridges of Madison County in only 11 days and watched it become a runaway bestseller upon its publication in 1992 and then a blockbuster 1995 film starring Clint Eastwood and Meryl Streep. "It all just came pouring out," Waller said of the writing process. "Almost couldn't keep up with the words. I don't know where they came from." Raised in the small town of Rockford, Iowa, Waller studied business education at the University of Northern Iowa and then business management at Indiana University, said the New York Times. He returned to his undergraduate alma mater as a professor in 1967, rising to become dean of the business school. Fed up with teaching, Waller took an unpaid leave of absence in 1990 and developed the idea for his debut novel while traveling through Madison County. "The initial reviews of Bridges were lukewarm at best," said the Washington Post. The Chicago Sun-Times described the book as syrupy, platitudinous pap, and others mocked its overwrought prose. "I am the highway and a peregrine," Kincaid says while in the throes of passion, "and all the sails that ever went to sea." But readers lapped it up. Bridges spent 164 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, including nearly a year at number one, and went on to sell an estimated 50 million copies worldwide. Waller relocated to a remote Texas ranch and continued writing with a focus on matters of the heart, said the Daily Telegraph. "Slow Waltz in Cedar Bend," about an affair between an economics teacher and a colleague's wife, was the third best-selling book of 1993. He released a sequel to Bridges, A Thousand Country Roads, in 2002. Waller rarely gave interviews. All the bad reviews had made him distrustful of the media. "I really do have a small ego," he said. "If you don't like the book and can say why, I am willing to listen." But the criticism turned to nastiness. I was stunned. On the Talking Points page, we have an article titled, "Ryan Care, Who Wins, Who Loses?" Martha Brawley of Monroe, North Carolina, voted for Donald Trump in the hope he could make insurance more affordable, said Abby Goodenough and Reed Abelson in the New York Times. Brawley, 55, is feeling increasingly nervous now that the House GOP has unveiled its long-awaited bill to replace Obamacare. The American Health Care Act, crafted by House Speaker Paul Ryan and supported by Trump, would replace Obamacare's income-based premium subsidies with age-based tax credits of $2,000 to $4,000 per year. Those credits would not cover nearly as much of the cost of premiums as the current subsidies do, raising health care costs for millions of Americans. At the same time, Ryan Care would put strict limits on Medicaid spending and kick millions off the program. Brawley herself would receive $5,188 less in tax credits per year under Ryan Care, and now fears she'll become one of the 14 million people the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimates would lose health care coverage right away. "I'm scared, I'll tell you that right now, to think about not having insurance at my age," says Brawley. Perversely enough, said Eric Levitz in NYMag.com, Ryan Care most benefits the young and middle-income urban elites who voted for Hillary Clinton, but it just hammers the older rural working-class voters who backed Trump. Rural counties would be hit particularly hard, said Anna Wild Matthews and Dante Cheney in the Wall Street Journal. Under Obamacare, subsidies were pegged to premium cost in each geographic area, which in rural regions tend to be higher because of a lack of competition among insurers. Not so with Ryan Care's tax credits. As a result, in Nebraska's Chase County, a 62-year-old currently earning about $18,000 a year would pay nearly $20,000 annually to get health insurance coverage under the House GOP plan, consulting firm Oliver Wyman estimates. Middle-income Americans, however, would get some relief from Ryan Care, said Henry Kerr in TheEconomist.com. Obamacare focused on helping lower-income people get insurance, and its income limits cost the middle class dearly. A family of four earning around $100,000 was forced into the same risk pool as the chronically ill, but earned too much to get the subsidies that shield those on low incomes from Obamacare's high premiums. Under Obamacare, many saw their premiums soar by 300% or more. Ryan Care offers them relief by raising the income ceiling for tax credits to $75,000 for individuals and $150,000 for couples. "Truth is, our current health care system is very badly broken," said Chip Roy in NationalReview.com. Ryan Care tries to remedy that, but it's too similar to Obamacare to make a major difference. "Only by fully repealing Obamacare can we let free markets and experimentation in the states give consumers real choice in making health care decisions without Washington interference." Without Obamacare's interference, said Margot Sanger Katz in NYTimes.com, millions of older and poorer Americans would have no health care at all. Look at what Ryan Care does to people in their 50s and 60s. Under Obamacare's rules, insurance companies can charge older adults no more than three times more than younger enrollees. but RyanCare increases that ceiling to 5 times while also providing smaller tax subsidies and letting insurers raise deductibles, leading to enormous out-of-pocket expenses. An average 64-year-old earning $26,500 would have to shell out $14,600 under the Republican health care plan, up from $1,700 under Obamacare, meaning they probably have to drop insurance altogether. RyanCare would have literally fatal consequences for another vulnerable group, said Herman Lopez in Vox.com. Amid the country's ongoing opioid epidemic, 1.3 million Americans currently receive drug addiction treatment under Medicaid. RyanCare allows states to drop those essential services, leaving millions of addicts stranded without potentially life-saving care. Care to guess where the billions of dollars in savings from these cuts would go instead? Said David Linhart in the New York Times. To the rich, of course, who would be RyanCare's biggest winners. Obamacare covered the cost of extending coverage to the poorest and sickest with a series of taxes on couples making more than $250,000. The Republican replacement law scraps those provisions, transferring back more than $600 billion in public health spending to the richest 1% of households. Indeed, the richest of the rich, the 0.1% of Americans who earn more than $3.75 million annually, would see their taxes fall by an average of $165,000 per year. RyanCare might do a poor job of helping uninsured Americans get health coverage, but as a tax cut for the wealthy, it would be a home run. ISIS, the end of the caliphate is near. ISIS is approaching the end of its short and terrible life, said Matthew Continetti in NationalReview.com. U.S.-backed Iraqi forces have already driven the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria from the eastern half of Mosul and are currently retaking the western half of the Iraqi city. In Syria, Kurdish militias are closing in on Raqqa, ISIS's de facto capital, ahead of a planned siege and assault that will end the terrorist group's existence as a state. But the Kurds aren't doing it alone. About 400 U.S. Marines and soldiers arrived in Syria last week to provide artillery support for the assault on Raqqa, nearly doubling the number of American troops deployed in the war-torn country. The looming question is, what happens the day after Raqqa falls? Does the U.S. keep troops in Syria to keep it from reverting to chaos, or pull out to avoid getting stuck in another quagmire? And who will make these difficult decisions? President Trump or his generals? The U.S. is currently performing a tricky balancing act in Syria, says Jared Malson in Time.com. Our troops are working closely with the People's Protection Units, YPG, a Kurdish militia. But the YPG has deep ties to Kurdish insurgents in Turkey. And the Turkish government, another U.S. ally, regards the group as an existential threat comparable to ISIS. The situation is so volatile that some U.S. forces have been deployed in the northern town of Manbij purely to keep our two allies from attacking each other. It's not even clear which fighters will actually seize Raqqa, said Michael Gordon in the New York Times. U.S. generals favor a mixed force of Syrian Arabs and the YPG. But Turkey won't be happy with that, and a secondary war may eventually erupt. Thus far, Trump has relied on the Obama blueprint for battling ISIS, says Max Boot in CommentaryMagazine.com. But when Raqqa falls, the commander-in-chief will have to make some hard decisions to prevent the kind of power vacuum that originally allowed ISIS to blossom. The U.S. probably has to leave some troops on the ground. But that would go completely against Trump's repeated pledge to end what he called the era of nation building. Which imperative will be more important to Trump? defeating ISIS for good, or keeping the U.S. out of long-term foreign interventions. And we'll see if we can squeeze in a couple of short notes. For the first time ever, bottled water has overtaken soda as the most popular beverage in the country. Americans bought 12.8 billion gallons of bottled water in 2016, up almost 9% since 2015, and some 400 million gallons more than the 12.4 billion gallons of carbonated soft drinks they consumed. China is home to 56 of the world's 88 self-made female billionaires. The U.S. has 15, the U.K. has 8, and 9 other countries have 1 apiece. And we'll finish out the hour with a quote. This is from the author E.L. Doctorow, quoted in the New York Times. He says, "You never see further than your headlights, but you can make the whole trip that way." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.